This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today's guests are Steve Fletcher and William Rabin. Steve Fletcher is partner in the Carroll Stroke Fletcher Gallery based on East Castle Street, London, West 1. From the gallery's website, Carroll Fletcher supports established and emerging artists whose work transcends traditional categorization, using diverse media in order to explore socio-political or technological themes. Established in 2012 by Jonathan Carroll and Steve Fletcher, the gallery has quickly emerged as a leading platform for contemporary art with an emphasis on multimedia and new technologies. As part of a digital presence, Carroll Fletcher On Screen is an online cinema showing dynamic, curated weekly screenings of experimental and artists' film scheduled to complement the gallery's programme. William Rabin is a distinguished artist filmmaker whose career began at St. Martin's in the late 1960s as a radical painter, tying canvases to trees and exposing them over a period of time to the elements, also printing canvases with thin solutions of oil paint on the surface of the sea, which sounds like a considerably more risky version of paper marbling. William soon became involved in experimental film, possibly as an extension of a time-based approach to media, leading to some of the most significant experimental films of that era, notably twin-screen films such as River Yar, with Chris Wellesby, and was a pioneer of expanded cinema, landscape film, film action, and was associated with the London Filmmakers Cooperative throughout the 1970s, later teaching fine art film at St. Martin's. The 1980s saw a digression from structural film theory, which nevertheless continues to inform Rabin's film practice, with the feature-length Black and Silver made with Marilyn Halford. That Black and Silver being the digression from structural film. And I quote, paraphrase in fact, 20 or 30 years later, the issues raised by structural film remained unresolved. In the background, we can hear the soundtrack from William Rabin's experimental documentary made in 1987 called Thames Film. Since Thames Film, there has been a sort of two-pronged approach, Island Race and London Republic, to name but two, which follow the direction of Thames Film, and MMX, perhaps a continuation of early experiments. Thames Film will be screened at Close-Up Cinema, Sclater Street, E1 6HR, on Thursday, May the 18th, along with Civil Disobedience, 2004, 3¼ minutes, a rapid time-lapse journey from the Houses of Parliament to the open sea, offset by David Cunningham's musical score composed from fragments of Margaret Thatcher's Belgrano speech. The last-named film being particularly relevant to today's wavelength, which came about due to a recent screening at Close Up Cinema, which featured a programme of six films by William Raeburn with a Q&A moderated by Steve Fletcher. That screening was determined by a statement by Jean-Luc Godard. The problem is not to make political films, but to make films politically. A statement which dates back to Godard's militant Maoist phase when he embarked on what might be called a scorched earth program of back-to-zero filmmaking, renouncing his earlier films and describing French cinema as Hollywood on the Seine. When he also said that to make films politically, one might have to stop making films at all, presumably to engage in politics as a priority. And another Godardism, the avant-garde is hopelessly involved with the bourgeois art world. And it's from there that we will launch today's wavelength.
Mm.
Good afternoon, Steve and William. Thank you very much for coming in. Steve.
I was wondering if I'm a representative of the bourgeois art world.
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked yourself that.
Whether it's interesting from, I think, with William's practice, we talked about earlier about the political element of William's work. And I think that it is interesting when we talk about me as a gallerist and William as a filmmaker, and William avowedly does not like showing film in the gallery space. And I think it would be interesting to get William's take on that, because I think there are two elements to that which I perceive. One is the element of the physical or the spatiotemporal experience of the gallery space versus the cinematic experience and the traditions of the two, and the second thing is a political thing about the nature of the commercial gallery system versus, I think, from William coming out to the London Filmmakers Co-op, and so perhaps that would be a good place to start, would be for William to talk a little bit about the
my objections to the gallery.
The objections to the gallery and the bourgeois
art world,
yeah.
Not that it's necessarily a bourgeois art world, but it's just that was a quote from Godard.
It's particularly pertinent, I think, at a time when Damien Hirst spends $50 million plus on an exhibition in Venice. I think, and when you have Documenta, for example, splitting between Kassel in Germany and Athens, and whether that's an example of art world neocolonialism. So I think it's a good point for William.
Interesting. Well, I mean, this is the very obvious point to make, that if you're concerned about showing a film and wanting it to be screened under optimal conditions, the cinema is the best place, more often than not. A fully blacked out space, a big screen, and even I prefer to show the early multi-screen works like Diagonal, Surface Tension, Wave Formations, even though they're harder to project in a cinema because of the physical constraint. I think those works work better in a cinema context rather than showing them in the white cube of the gallery. Because they make a comment on the institutional nature of the cinema. Cinema as institution.
Right. Yes. That's interesting. I'm quite surprised by that, actually. I find that quite baffling, because, I mean, your films, certainly the expanded cinema presentations, would seem to be more suited to a gallery space in that it's but perhaps your films do always have a beginning and an end. They don't run as loops or continuously, do they?
That's right.
So that would lend itself more to a sort of theatrical presentation. But do you always require the audience to be seated and in one place, in which case that is the cinema space?
Yeah, I like a seated audience for those works.
Yeah.
I think there's a tendency, if you show your work in a gallery, as I've done on several occasions, well, many occasions, it's a kind of a sampling thing with the audience coming and going as they please and not seeing or feeling the work as a durational thing.
Right.
And is some of that, is it the expanded cinema, you know, very akin to performances?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a lot of those expanded cinema works, I mean, it's a problem that we all have now. I mean, the last of those works was 1977, Wave Formations, five-screen film. And I'm faced with the problem of having to archive it somehow. Mm-hmm. And this is very difficult, you know, sort of transferring it to digital media when it was intended as 16-millimeter projection for five projectors.
Yeah. But the sort of amount of spaces that could have ever shown such a thing must have been very limited at the time that you made them. I mean, this is presumably why they go into a gallery, because of the...
Yeah, museum stroke galleries. Because I think a lot of the co-op screenings, we showed quite a lot in museum spaces of one kind and another.
Yes. There was the Gallery 1 screening, presumably. Is that what you're referring to? Gallery 1?
Gallery House?
Gallery House, sorry. Gallery House, which has been recently sort of revived at Raven Row.
That's right.
And you also showed Film Action events at the Tanks in the Tate Modern.
Yeah.
None of which would be regarded as a sort of a conventional cinema space.
No.
See, I think one of the things I think is worth unpacking, which links directly to this, is, you know, William has talked about being able to be more transgressive in the cinema, and also one of the things that prompted him to move into this sort into structuralist filmmaking was a reaction against the institution of cinema, and therefore to really experience the transgressive nature and examination of the apparatus of cinema in its broadest, you know, in its full sense. I think it's the right place to show it, because you don't have...
Which is the right place to show it? Sorry.
In the cinema.
Right.
Because in the gallery space, it is not nested within those constraints, that system that it is attempting to critique. And that's the challenge. The challenge today is to find cinemas that are spatially set up to enable you to do that. You can do it as Raven Row did it and did a really good job, but it is only a partial experience of the work. I mean, I think...
Yeah, I mean, talk about a particular work, expanded cinema work, Take Measure, 1973, where the image on the screen is film being dragged through a footage counter at 24 frames a second. And when that's shown in the cinema with the film seen snaking back through the seats of the audience, back into the projection booth, I think it's got much more impact than it has when it's shown in a white cube, where to some extent, or to a large extent, the space between the screen and the projector is, in a sense, it's indeterminate.
Mm-hmm.
So I much prefer to show that work in a cinema, even though it's very difficult sometimes to do it.
Has it been shown in cinemas?
Yeah, several times.
Has it? Which ones?
I had it shown in Oberhausen Film Festival, in the big cinema there.
Right, which is where I first came across William's work.
Is it? I was going to ask you, that was going to be one of my questions, about how you first encountered William's films and how that came, how it then led to your association.
At the Oberhausen Film Festival.
Yeah. When was that?
2015, I think it would have been.
And did you have a particular interest in film to start with? Were you looking for filmmakers? Was it a gallery policy to start introducing film as part of your agenda? Or
It was an area of interest. And so going to Oberhausen and being involved in Oberhausen is a reflection of of the gallery's belief that, well, two things. One is that film and video is becoming increasingly important as an art within the contemporary art world, let's call it, the visual art world, and that artist practice is changing so that people aren't necessarily film and video makers, they're just artists, and they have multimedia practices. And so within that context, it's important if you're working with those artists to have some sense of the history of film and video, in order to for you to be able to help, you know, to critique the artists you're working with as well as understand their position in art history. And so going to Oberhausen was a reflection of in this particular one, because the screenings that William was part of were organized by a filmmaker called Mika Tanila, whose work I know really well. And I thought if Mika was programming this at Oberhausen, it was bound to be interesting because he's steeped far more than I am in the history.
Right.
And it was a fantastic, you know, where they had like Valley Export films and all sorts of things.
Right.
And William stood out.
Right.
As work that was really, you know, engaged both with the structure of film and video, both from a technical point of view as well as an art historical point of view. But the works were coming out, you know, where their form and their content, they're, if like from an aesthetic dimension, were actually interesting. I find quite a lot of it quite dry and almost academic.
A lot of what? Do you
a lot of work in this area,
in that area,
in expanded
sure.
cinema.
Yep.
And so there was that yeah. you know, you were seeing this work within that context, and it stood out as work that was just, apart from anything else, witty. You know, that, and I think that, and that was engaging the audience and wasn't, and that's something we're always looking for.
Right.
And then actually in the same program, if I remember right, there was Time and the Wave.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Which is another film of Williams that we showed in the first close-up screening. And which is talking about Thatcher's funeral, you know, and state funerals. And again, what struck me about that piece of filmmaking was that it was deeply politically engaged. And for me, interesting because it was partial. It wasn't afraid of making various points, but it wasn't propaganda. It was open, discursive filmmaking. And as Williams says, you know, making films is about showing people things, not telling them how to interpret the world.
Right.
End quote. And I think that's really important. If you're going to make films politically, is you're not making propaganda. You're making films that are asking people, inviting people to engage with the crucial socio-political issues of our time. And
but how does that differ? I mean, how does one differentiate then between a political film and a film made politically?
Well, I think it's a shift in emphasis from films that are political in their content to films that are political in terms of the way they're produced. And to give a sort of general example of that, I mean, I think that phrase from Godard comes from 1968 or thereabouts, 1969 perhaps.
Yeah, I tried to track it down. I did try and find the source of it. It's quite difficult. It seems to relate to the Ziegler-Vertov group.
That's right, the Ziegler-Vertov group, which was formed in 68, 69.
Yeah, there was Le Gay Savoir.
Yeah.
Seems to have been, and I've got this copy of After Image number one, which is about film and politics, which dates from 1970. And there is a piece by Godard here, and it says, "What is to be done?"
Yes.
Which is a phrase from Lenin, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right? And the first two, there's a sort of like a manifesto. And point one is, we must make political films. Point two is, we must make films politically. And point three is, one and two are antagonistic to each other and belong to two opposing conceptions of the world.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
So that's 1970. But
yeah.
As you say, it probably dated from 68, from a sort of, it was an avowedly Maoist phase, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can look at an organisation like the London Filmmakers Co-op that was formed in 1967 and see that in the way in which it was formed as being a good example of political in terms of the way films were produced, because within the London Filmmakers Co-op there was the distribution, there was the cinema, and there was the workshop, all within the same organization.
Yeah.
And I know that for a lot of more politically content, let's say, political in terms of content groups like Berwick Street Collective and Cinema Action, who the co-op, you know, people at the co-op had quite good relations with those people. They were very envious that we'd been successful in bringing those three aspects together within the same organization, and I think you could see that as being political.
Right. And in fact, yes, in fact, there's another article in here where they refer to the idea of distribution being as important as the making of the films, because, you know, you can make films, but they'll just exist in a sort of limbo unless they are somehow presented.
But it's the, I think there's three levels, I think, working here, one of which, in effect, Godard doesn't mention, which is, if you like, you've got propaganda, and films that are didactic, that are teaching, that are telling rather than showing, if you like.
Mm.
And then I think there's the films that are offering people a way into thinking about and making manifest certain issues, and that's about and where the content is political, and it might not be overtly political, it might be slightly more covert. But there's still the structure of the film, the content of the film is in some way political. And then making films politically is about what it says, the manner of making the film. Mm. And that's about, you know, this is what I think was crucial to Godard in that Maoist phase, was the idea of not being embedded within the capitalist systems of production and distribution, that you were making films that were true to your political affiliations. And so you do it in a cooperative manner, for example.
Yeah, yes, but I suppose the issue there is that the co-op was really a collection of individuals, wasn't it? Mostly artist filmmakers who... There was very... Correct me if I'm wrong, but there wasn't very much collective filmmaking as such.
No, but there was quite a lot of collective exhibition, I think, particularly the film action shows that I organised in 1973.
Right.
Which brought the work of the co-op under that big umbrella with a big show at in Liverpool at the Walker Art Gallery, and then it travelled.
Yeah.
So perhaps less, but we did help each other on each other's films to some extent.
Right. But aren't they essentially
auteur?
I mean, it comes out of the sort of dare I say it, the sort of brackage kind of, it's the visionary single individual with an idea of a film, which, yes, you might use other, obviously, no film is, all films are made with the use of a lab or you know, the someone else has built the camera. I mean, all the technology exists, you know, could be seen in a wide way as being a collective activity, but the actual film itself is surely, generally speaking, within the art world, is one person's position, rather than something, say, the Berwick Street Collective and those sorts of socialist filmmakers who would probably try and make a crew, you know, have a crew of people, all of whom were employed.
Yeah.
And that argument extends into the film industry, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does.
You know, but presumably even within the film industry, you can't, no one does away with the idea of a director as such. I don't know of any films made by committee.
No. But, I mean, going back to the filmmakers' co-op, certainly I think it's true to say that, you know, we were involved in building, you know, both printing and processing machines for getting the work made.
Right.
And that was of benefit not just to the person maybe doing the building, but also to the larger body of filmmakers using the co-op.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with that. So it was an idealistic model
Yeah.
for filmmaking. We won't go into whether or not it failed.
Yeah.
Perhaps another time.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a very long
discussion.
I'm not
saying it failed because it has a lasting influence, but it doesn't exist anymore.
No, no. And also means of filmmaking have changed completely since the 1970s.
Well, that's interesting. So the idea of distribution now, can we say anything about that? I mean, you show, is it on Vimeo or your film, the gallery?
Well, the on-screen program is through a website.
Right.
And yes, Vimeo is embedded, the Vimeo frames are embedded within the website. So it is relying on Vimeo ultimately, but it's not a Vimeo platform in the sense that it's not a section within Vimeo.
Okay. But is this the new distribution?
I think it has to be seen as one of the outlets, for sure.
Right. Right.
But of course it's a problem, because if you depend for any return on the films you make on rentals, and you make your work freely available on Vimeo, you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Right. Okay. Well, that's enough.
I mean, what we mostly end up doing is having work that is distributed. I mean, my work's distributed through the Lux. Is that we have our work on Vimeo, but it's passworded.
Right.
So you can send the link and the password to a curator interested in screening it or promoting it in some way.
Yeah, yeah. It's a strange position at the moment, though, isn't it? I went to a Kenneth Anger screening at the ICA. I didn't get in, but I asked him at the screening, I said, will your films be on DVD, these latest ones? He showed 10 new films.
Yeah.
And he said, no, he doesn't want them on DVD because he knows they'll just get ripped off and put on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so we're now in the strange position where you can't see them.
Yeah.
I mean, he's represented by a gallery in, I can't remember what it's called, it's not Hauser, Spruth Majors, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so it's a strange situation now where you've got things like Vimeo, but a filmmaker like that doesn't want them shown on Vimeo because they're just going to get distributed for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, because was it you or Steve mentioned earlier, you know, sort of possibly a link between performance art and expanded cinema?
That was Steve.
Right, okay. Yeah. And it led me to recall a wonderful quote, which I'll try and remember, by, who is it? You might know. That performance art only exists by virtue of its disappearance.
Okay. Oh.
Do you remember that one?
It'll come back to me.
A performance art theorist, right. and I feel that, you know, that's the same with a lot of the expanded cinema work.
Yeah, but that brings us back, because film and performance and conceptual art, I mean, do they more or less coincide? They were all attempts in a way to be un-gallerizable, as it were.
For want
of a better word, it was an attempt to get out of the gallery situation.
Yes, and I think that
there, or to make things that couldn't be sold, let us say.
Yes, and certainly I think that structural film comes out to a certain extent from performance art.
Ah, I haven't heard that one before. Right. That's interesting.
Okay. I think it was a day... Performance Art Weekend a few years ago now, and Marina Abramović was speaking. And there's a whole, in the performance art world, there's a similar set of discussions about how you commercialize and what's, should you restage things and should you photograph things and all these, you know. And the same old debate was going on, and Abramović basically said that she just decided, admittedly late in her career, that everybody else was managing to make some money out of her work. And it was about time that she made some money from her work.
Yeah.
and I think then sort of started to think more deeply about the nature of the work and what it meant to reproduce things or to have... traces of a performance or documentation of a performance. And I think we're still wrestling with some of these issues.
Mm.
As a
gallery, you are a gallerist.
Mm-hmm.
How does this work with you? I mean, how on earth do you use sales from other works in order to sponsor the unsellable, or do you see the unsellable as the future sort of? What are the economics of this?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions within what you've just said. I think the first thing that's always worth remembering when it comes to, I think, probably 100% of commercial galleries, is they've always started with people who really love art and recognize and really enjoy some practices that aren't particularly commercially viable. Right. And so when you look at lots of galleries, you will see that they have practices that aren't overtly commercial, and indeed they're not commercial, but they are artists that the gallery, for whatever reason, really respects and wants to work with and wants to help, and they're never going to make any money out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they've made, they understand that, yeah. And it's part about, and also it's about having a diversified portfolio of artists and.
Right.
But it's enjoyable, because that's what a lot of people are in it for. So I think there's that's what always worth remembering.
Right.
That they may not then. Then the next, I think one other thing that comes out of what you've just said is that from our point of view, it's important that the work comes first and that you understand what the nature of the work is and the artist produces the work, and then you start to think about, after it's being produced, you need to start to think about it earlier than that. But, what you don't do is you don't create something in order for it to sell. So if you're making a film, I think one of the things that's important to recognize is most films don't make any money. So how do you raise the money to help the filmmaker make the film?
Mm-hmm.
And then, given the nature of the film, what's the right distribution mechanism, and does it make sense for it to be editioned?
Yeah.
And and then sold as an edition, and it's still a bloody difficult sell.
Yeah.
Because there aren't many people who are interested in collecting it.
No.
but I think one of the important things about the editioning process, and this came up, I was at the launch of Erica Balsam's new book last night at Lux, which sort of is a history of almost like an economic history of the artist film and video, experimental cinema to some extent. And she was in conversation with Ben Cook. And a lot of it was about this.
Okay.
And one of the important points that came up was that the process of editioning things that seem like they should be, available just as unlimited editions as DVD, and that's the democratic thing to do.
Mm.
One of the issues is, how do you ensure that that work is preserved for the future? And one of the ways is that you have multiple custodians of that work who are, going to actively look after it because they have an interest in looking after it.
Right. It sounds like a kind of archiving in anticipation of something. It sounds like a sort of premature archiving, I would call it.
Well, it's just recognizing that, work is produced and
it's almost accepting that it can't be shown in any other way, so therefore we'll look after it for the future.
No, I think it's accepting that work is worth preserving.
Sure.
And that one way of doing that is to actually almost to appoint custodians.
Right.
Because as William mentioned right at the start about particularly the expanded cinema works, the difficulties of take measure.
Hmm.
From conserving it and making sure that it doesn't degrade and it still exists.
Yeah.
For future generations, I think is really important.
Sure.
So I think that's part of this process. And the other part of the process is, and it comes down to particularly with expanded cinema works, that there's then an interest in what are the optimal conditions for showing the work and making sure that those are understood and documented. and that that we again, there are people making sure that that's what happens.
Right.
So that what you don't get, which you see, you get, is films that are shot on 4:3 that are shown on 16:9.
Yeah.
Or people who get the compression ratios wrong or whatever, or the compression and the compressing the film wrong, and then it looks terrible when it's shown. There's all sorts of issues.
Okay. Can I just, I'm going to quickly return briefly to the subject of political film, and then perhaps we can move on to talking about Thames film. Is that okay?
Good.
I mean, it's just another quote from a book. This is another issue of After Image, which was about English independent cinema. And it's quite an overlooked article, I think, by Mike Dunford, called Experimental Avant-Garde Revolutionary Film Practice, which tends to get sort of somewhat overshadowed, I think, by Peter Goodall's theorising. And it actually sounds a bit like, it's almost like the sort of comment you get from a splinter group of the Revolutionary Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist or something. It's a very interesting piece, but he says, what is left in experimental film? Is it so totally reactionary that nothing of value can be extracted from it? What is useful in experimental film and is essential as one of the components of a revolutionary film practice is the beginnings of a materialist, and he goes on like this. Clearly, the position of experimental film within an art practice must be abandoned for that to take place. The reality of the medium and its intervention in social practice and the total destruction of capitalism cannot be achieved so long as it continues to function as a support to capitalist institutions. The experimental film movement, particularly in its early stages, has contained the seeds for such a transformation and still does, despite its consequent and inevitable recuperation into the capitalist system. So that's Mike Dunford writing in 1976, actually. This conundrum of that is that Mike Dunford sort of made a film like Still Life with Pear, which is hard to equate with a revolutionary film practice, as far as I can see, but anyway. But do you want to, any rejoinders to that, or should we move on to Thames film?
Let's move on to Thames film.
Okay. All right.
That's a wonderful clip from the film City of Ships that was commissioned by the Port of London Authority, made in 1940. And throughout Thames film, there are a number of clips of films, four films in total, that were held by the Port of London Authority archive. And I've been thinking recently, especially with this close-up screening coming up, how the fact that I made that film when I did, 1984 to 1986, was very fortuitous at a number of different levels. One is that I was able to get access to the wonderful archive that the Port of London Authority had. It's now held by the Museum of London, but at that time it was in a very scruffy warehouse near St. Catherine's Dock in East London. And I was given free access to this archive. The person looking after it, a wonderful man called Bob Aspinall, said, you can use anything for the film that you find of interest. And I came across this wonderful manuscript they had, leather-bound volume by the travel writer Thomas Pennant, 1787, called A Voyage from London to Dover. And it was full of the most amazing engravings, other images, maps of the period, historical material as well. And at that stage, I realized that I wanted to incorporate it into the film. And I was given permission, which would be unbelievable now, to take the book away and for it to be filmed under the rostrum camera by my partner, Begonia. I mean, Bob did tell me that he had no sleep that weekend because he thought he'd made a terrible mistake. He wondered whether he'd ever see that book again. But, I mean, it was possible to do that.
And it's just, this is the book you see in the film with the pages being turned. The sound of that is quite remarkable, isn't it?
What, the sound of the pages turning? Yeah. It sounds brutal. And in fact, you've got to remember, because it was shot on a rostrum camera, it's being shot one frame at a time. So those pages turning are literally animated. You know, little movement.
Oh, really?
Little movement. Oh, okay. Click. And yet the sound is quite brutal of the pages being
turned. Yes, there's almost a sort of, hard to describe the sound, but you get this, it's almost a click as each page turns.
That's right. And of course that was done, you know, just by waving a sheet of cartridge paper under a microphone.
Okay, all right. Steve, anything to...
Well, I think that sort of plays into an interesting question about William's filmmaking, which is he kindly shared with me his two Arts Council applications for the film, because it was in fact originally conceived as a 30-minute film, and then during the process of making the film, that changed, and William had to submit a second application to complete the filmmaking. But he talks about his filmmaking, the film we made, by a sampling process. And I think it's interesting for William to talk a little bit perhaps about that process of filmmaking, because one of the things that when William's, you know, making a film, so when he was turning the pages, I'm guessing you were not recording the sound of those pages being turned.
There'll be nothing to record, essentially. Yeah. It'd been silent.
Because when William makes a film, the soundtrack is recorded separately
on the image.
From the images.
Several reasons for that. One is I tend to use a very noisy camera. so that makes sense.
What do you use, by the way?
For Thames film, I used a Bolex. A Bolex and a Beaulieu.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And...
They both were a bit, don't they?
They do, and more recently an Arri ST.
Okay.
Which makes even more noise.
Oh, right.
But you were asking about the sampling process. Mm. So I'm taking... I mean, the basic premise for the film was I wanted to make a film about London from the point of view of the river. Mm. And I found out the means for doing that was to film from a boat drifting on the tide going down the river.
So you waited for it's not the ebb tide, is it? What do we call it?
Well, it's filmed both on the ebb tide and the flood, depending on which side of the bank. I mean, first of all...
But you allow the boat just to be carried with the tide?
Yeah, so it's travelling at the speed at which the river is moving.
Right.
Which was quite important.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And I had to decide, you know, which side of the boat was I going to film from? And it seemed the most obvious thing to do was to film from the port side. The starboard side.
Uh-huh.
Simply because of the rules of navigation mean that if you're passing a boat coming in the opposite direction, you have to pass port to port.
Oh, yes. Right.
So filming from the starboard side put me closest to the nearest riverbank.
Right.
And sometimes I'm filming drifting down the river out towards the open sea, and sometimes on the way back as well, with the flood tide coming the other way.
Does it have a logic of going in and coming out again in one motion, or is it intercut?
I mean, the initial intention was that I was going to make the film over quite a short period of time during the winter, and I changed that quite rapidly because I wanted to have all the seasonal changes in the film. So it's actually shot over 2 years.
Right. Oh, really?
Duration.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was always on the basis of sampling, so, you know, be taking maybe... You know, maybe I'd go out on a good day, I might come back with 100 feet of film. On a less good day, I might come back with 20 or 30 feet or 50 feet.
Right,
so sampling in that sense. And then again, the sound was made in a very similar way.
Right.
Recording sounds on the river using a Walkman.
Yeah. So I'm watching, I'm sort of looking at it on the laptop. I can see it on the laptop, but you can't. But you can hear the soundtrack, I think.
The explorer, the judge, the young bride.
Yeah, that's again the clip from City of Ships.
All of these hardly identifiable in the masses of men and women who, with their belongings, pass along the gangways of Tilbury and sail for destinations thousands of miles away in foreign cities and outlying posts.
I mean, the voices in those films, which weren't made that long ago, I mean... 1951. People are still alive who lived through that period.
Right.
And yet the values have changed completely, and that sort of pompous voiceover was something I was definitely not wanting in the film that I was making. So I'm sort of lifting those as quotes from historical time.
Right. And you, on the subject of voices, you use John Hurt as a voiceover.
Yes.
Occasional. It's very subtle.
Yeah.
Because it's only occasionally, isn't it, that his voice comes in.
You've already heard on the soundtrack before you hear John
from
Hurt.
Hence the Thames is this here?
This is John Hurt, yes. But before that, you've heard T.S. Eliot reading extracts from the name four quartets.
Oh, right.
And
the Hope Anchorage for homeward bound vessels is named from the mariner's
I felt it was important. I felt
that
there were several sections in the four quartets that I thought were important to have in the film. And I thought the only thing I can do if I have this is to see if there's an existing recording of T.S. Eliot reading his own work.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there was no commercial release of the now famous reading of four quartets by Eliot.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the National Sound Archive, which then was in Kensington. It's now part of the British Library. And they said, yes, we found you, the recording. And they kindly made me a copy, which I was able to license to use for the film. And coming back to John Hurt, I wanted his voice for its texture as much as anything else. I mean, it was a problem when I was editing the film. Who's going to be able to read this in the right way? And John Hurt was just wonderful.
Mm. Well, he has a very distinctive voice.
He does,
doesn't he?
Yes. Very gravelly.
Good. Yes. Yeah.
On this journey, time is exposed. The past and present form one continuous pattern of unfolding experience.
But when we were in the recording studio, I made a mistake. I hadn't realized. I should have sent him the picture so that he knew what kind of film I was making. Because when we did the first take and he was reading through all the sections I'd typed out for him, he read it incredibly fast. And so I said, no, John, it's got to be much slower than that. And so he read it slower. And I said, no, it's got to be slower than that still. And he said, God, if I read it any slower, I'm going to fall asleep. But he did a wonderful job on the soundtrack. But I think if I'd given him the visual cue of the picture to work with, he would have got it. He would have felt that.
But the film has a very specific pace to it, doesn't it?
It does. It's slow and reflective.
But it's the pace of the river.
Exactly. The pace is it determined by the river then?
I like to think that it is, yes.
And how far do you go up through the bridges, under the bridges?
I start off from Temple Stairs, which is where the Pennant Journal starts.
Right.
Where he starts his voyage down to Dover, which he makes over a period of time too. It's many successive journeys.
Yeah.
And then it goes all the way out to the open sea.
Hmm.
To try,
perhaps we can bring in your. I mean, there is a sort of a direction of these films that you've made. You've made several films in this sort of genre, shall we say? Is that fair to say?
I don't like genre.
No.
I mean, it's like Steve and I've been having this discussion about whether it's an essay film or whether it's a documentary.
Well, William described it as an experimental documentary earlier.
In the Arts Council application.
No.
Oh, right. Okay.
No, even that.
I don't like categorizations.
No, but you've made several films, which I mean, the Island Race and so on. They're about London.
Yes,
they have a similar aesthetic, I think.
Yes, maybe a similar motivation.
Yeah. Just as a complete aside, there's the one which has the funeral of, is it Ronnie Cray?
Yes, that's Island Race.
Island Race. The first time I saw that, I almost jumped out of the seat because there's one of these hearses being pulled by horses, you know.
Yeah.
And it says on the side, W. English and
Son. That's right. That's right. Of course, Bethnal
and
Green
thought,
Undertaker.
Oh, my God, it's like some horrible sort of omen or something. see your own, you know, it's W.
Yeah,
English.
Of course it does.
And in fact, there is the Undertaker, he's on Bethnal Green Road.
That's right.
And I pass it sometimes. Whenever I see it, I think, oh, no, I'm going to look away.
Oh.
It's like, but, yeah, so that's the Cray funerals. You actually filmed that.
Yeah.
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 And what's the one that's showing coming up at Close Up Cinema? There's a short film, Civil Disobedience.
Yes, right.
I mean, would you say that was in a similar
Well, it's a journey area. Film, like right. Thames film is. It's about as close as it gets to Thames film in that way. I mean, it's a very different film. It's shot time-lapse, a journey from London to... It's a little village next to Dover. And then the last shot is looking out over the English Channel. And what will be nice about the screening in close-up, because normally I've shown that film digitally.
Uh-huh.
And on digital projection, it's not sufficient resolution to see that there is the coast of France in the distance. But that was important for
me. Oh, that's interesting. So what you mean, in film you can see it?
Yeah. It's clear on the print.
Because I was going to bring that up, this issue of digital and film. Because, again, I went to a screening of your films at the National Film Theatre.
Yes.
And I always remember distinctly, you showed Thames film, I think, as a film.
Oh, that's right.
And another film which had a sort of Dickensian theme to it of some sort.
That was The Houseless Shadow.
Right. You showed that, which is digital.
Yeah.
And in the talk afterwards, you actually said something like that you thought that looking at the film was a bit like listening to music on a Dansett record player now.
That's specific to 16mm. I mean, 16mm optical is not very good. It's not terribly good.
Right.
So it's mono, which is fine if the sound is intended to be mono. But I did make the
sound. But you do still think that film has the edge in certain aspects?
In terms of projection?
Well, because you just said that you could see the French coast in film, but you couldn't see it in digital.
Yes, this is because... When I made the digital version of Civil Disobedience, it's telecined using single definition, not high definition. If I got a high definition transfer, it would probably be better than the 35mm print.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's all.
And also, there's a difference between transferring and filming.
Right.
In the sense of filming in digital versus transferring from 16 or 35mm. And what gets lost or gained in the transfer.
Yeah.
As William's saying.
Right. So perhaps we should mention again that Close-Up Cinema on May the 18th, which is a Thursday.
7:30.
That's on Sclater Street. Is it E2? I think it's E2. I've got it somewhere.
It's E2.
It's here somewhere. Yeah, E1.
Oh, E1.
E1 6HR. Close-Up Cinema. Thames Film will be showing there. Along with Civil Disobedience, a short film. Anything else being shown there? Just those two?
Just those two.
And will you be there, Steve?
We will. There'll be a Q&A afterwards.
Right. So once again, Steve Fletcher will lead a Q&A at the end of that screening.
So it's everybody's chance to talk to William.
Indeed, yeah. And ask questions that I haven't thought of. So that's a Close-Up Cinema, Thursday, May the 18th. And today you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with filmmaker William Raban and gallerist Steve Fletcher. And in the background, we're still running the soundtrack from Thames film. I particularly love the scene where it shows those forts, which are quite...
They're just coming up. It's a shame your listeners can't see the pictures.
tell us a bit about the forts, because they're extraordinary
forts.
Constructions, aren't they?
They are. They're amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were built as anti-aircraft gun emplacements in the Second World War.
Right.
But they were built up pretty much after the end of the Blitz, so they didn't have much value to the defence of the country.
I can see them now. They've just come up. I mean, the most extraordinary structures.
Yes.
Which are still there?
They're still there. Yeah. They're still there. There's a number of groups of them off the Kent coast, one at Shivering Sands and the other at East Red Sands.
Right.
And there are more in the outer estuary. There used to be even more still. There was one that called, I think, the Tongue Fort, which still had its gun on it rusting away.
Right. So they haven't been sold as luxury apartments yet?
No, they have been used. One of them was used in the 60s as a pirate radio station.
Right, yes. Yeah.
It's just the seagulls now.
We should perhaps just talk about the two films that people can easily see, because I think they're particularly pertinent.
Okay.
So we at Carol Fletcher have a website that screens films and also actually does sort of online exhibitions, which is www.carolfletcheronscreen.com. And at the moment, we're screening two of William Shorter films, London Republic and Available Light.
Right.
And London Republic was made by William and released actually for free onto Vimeo 2 months before the Brexit referendum, and has an uncanny prediction about both the outcome of the referendum but also about what the outcome would prompt, or what the vote, if you like, the outcome of the vote and what that would prompt in terms of changes to the UK. And in particular, it's called London Republic because it predicts that London will vote overwhelmingly
to break away,
to remain in Europe,
okay,
as will Scotland.
Right.
And as a result, London will break away as from the rest of the UK and form a republic, and Scotland will break away. So it was interesting to think first as a political provocation prior to that. I think it's a wonderfully wonderful piece of filmmaking. But also I think it's worth watching to bring a smile to people's face about is this what hard Brexit would mean? But maybe, William, you could just say a few words about what prompted you to make London Republic.
I was angry. I was angry at the potential that the outcome might be to leave. And I was fairly convinced that London would not vote for leave, but would be the majority of London, as it turned out, were Remainers. And speculating about, you know, I mean, it's a satirical fairy tale, unapologetically, you know, kind of in the spirit of Oscar Wilde's short stories, perhaps.
Well, there was Passport to Pimlico, of course,
wasn't
there?
Yes, that's right, that's
which
right.
Which in a similar vein, perhaps.
Yeah.
In fact, yes, perhaps I'd have to have another look at that sometime.
Yes, yes, but London Republic is deliberately absurdist.
Right.
So it kind of imagines that, you know, there's no need anymore for the Houses of Parliament, so that it gets turned into a refugee centre.
Right.
And, you know, or no, a homeless centre. And it was Buckingham Palace. Well, the Queen's been moved off to Windsor, and Buckingham Palace has turned into a homeless centre.
Right.
It deliberately absurdist.
Yeah.
And then the companion piece to that, Available Light, is William reading in time lapse the
Das Kapital.
Volume 1 of Das Kapital.
Right. In down to 9 minutes, I think.
Down to 9 minutes.
Why was it called Available Light?
Because it's shot under a window, and the simple rule for making the film was that it was only shot. It was shot in February when it was very cold in my studio, and I could only shoot during the hours of daylight.
Uh-huh. So okay.
It's mostly shot from about 7 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
Over 6 days.
Yeah. And this is apparently, as you were saying earlier, this is the first time you've read. Did you actually read the book whilst you were
filming?
Oh,
I had to do that. That was kind of the purpose for me in making the film.
Right.
And I calculated that I wanted a film 8 minutes long.
Well, we're running out of time. Thank you very much again to Steve Fletcher and William Raeburn for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you, William.
Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.